chopped liver. No.
Exactly.
Okay. So how many people live, you think?
I don't know. Last time we almost maxed out. The room holds 1,000. Hi, everybody. The room holds 1,000. And then we're also going to stream it live on Facebook, in my Facebook, our Facebook group. So that has 24,000 people in it. And we will see. We'll see what happens there. But right now it's telling me that it's not letting me go there. So give me a second.
Anyway. Hi, everybody.
Yeah, welcome. Say hi.
Good morning, everyone.
Here we go. All right. Welcome, everyone. I'm just getting a little tech stuff situated, so we will be smooth sailing. Let's see. Here we go. Got it.
Oh, it's wonderful to see everyone's popping in the chat where they're from.
Awesome. Yes, please tell us where you're from.
That's wonderful. All over the world. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Allison.
And some people from some very warm United States states. Apparently, lots of heat going on.
A lot of heat. And Dr. Pimentel, where are you? Just to give everybody some background.
Oh, I'm in Los Angeles right now, and all's well here.
Great.
Not so hot. So.
And you're in the MAST program building right now, right?
Correct. That's what's behind me right here. Is some of the, you might see some of the MAST folks sort of drifting by behind me because people work. So it's a busy place.
Which is so exciting. That's all good. That is all good. All right. Hi, everyone. We will start officially. We have just a minute till we start at 12:15, but no harm in introducing you to our very special guests. Dr. Allison Seebecker is here from the world famous SIBOinfo.com. Hi, Allison.
Hello.
Dr. Seebecker is a world-renowned SIBO expert, and she's working on her book right now, and she has done the SIBO Pro course for all those pros out there who needs true SIBO training, as well as co-created with me, but it's her content, the SIBO Recovery Roadmap course for patients. And I just want to say welcome to all of you all who are in our courses. And if not, we'll see you at the other webinars and all that jazz. And of course, Dr. Mark Pimentel is here. Dr. Pimentel is going to be sharing with us the information from the recent Digestive Disease Week. He's the author of this book, which I highly recommend that you get ASAP. And he's a professor of medicine and gastroenterology at Geffen School of Medicine, UCLA, an associate professor of medicine at Cedars-Sinai, Los Angeles. He's also the head of Pimentel Laboratory and the executive director of the Medically Associated Science and Technology Program at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. Dude, that is a mouthful.
And that's actually just the beginning.
It is, seriously. And then just a small shout out because I'm so excited. This is my book, Healing SIBO, but it just got published in Polish, everybody. So we're getting the word out there. The mission continues. And I am going to have you start, Dr. Pimentel, because we are right on time and have so much to get to.
Oh, it's so good to see you both. And wow, welcome everybody. It's a large audience. I can see the number of participants growing as we get started here. Well, I'm really excited this time because I really think we're coming to the end of a big part of the chapter on this. And I know we'll have a lot to talk about as we continue to unfold these slides. So as always, I'm going to show my slides, but I'm going to show you the slides as I show them to scientists, but explain them to you so that you understand them. Those of you who are practitioners and those of you who are just looking for information, everybody should understand this clearly. But so here I share my screen and you should see my slides. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, perfect.
Are you able to make them full? Yeah, there you go. And by the way, everyone, I forgot to mention, please don't use the chat during Dr. Pimentel's presentation unless you're having a tech issue. It's really distracting. And if you have a question, this is not a Q&A. It is a presentation. But I know what that's like to have a burning question and think, maybe they'll get to it. Maybe. Don't be distracted by that, but you can put it in the Q&A box. No guarantees. But main thing we're here to do is learn from Dr. Pimentel today. Go for it.
All right. Well, thanks again. And let me start by one thing. I mean, one of the things that I commonly get both on social media and questions from people is, when are we going to get treatments? When are we going to get treatments? And let me just tell you that we can chew gum and walk at the same time. And we are chewing gum and walking at the same time. But what you have to understand is SIBO of 2010 is not SIBO of 2022. And we have to continue to understand SIBO, where it's located, how it's distributed, in order to perfect the best treatments. Having said that, we're already in progress with clinical trials of new products and new technologies for SIBO on the basis of research I'm presenting today. The other thing, let me tell you, is whenever I present research today, it's because it's public information. But we also have research we've already done that has not yet been public information. So we're always about a year ahead of what I'm presenting here, which makes me even more excited because there's other things coming. But also to tell you that we're not behind, it's just we can't talk about things that are not yet public information. But stay tuned because there's going to be a hell of a lot more now that we have all of this stuff that you're going to hear today. I always show this slide as the mechanism of IBS and SIBO. Now, I talk about IBS and SIBO together because we think that about 60 to 70% of irritable bowel syndrome is SIBO. And while SIBO can be caused by a lot of different things, anything that slows the gut down can cause SIBO, like adhesions and other things. The biggest, the gorilla in the room, is the IBS category. And we think about 60 to 70% of SIBO is IBS. And we've made a lot of advances in this area. And so what we show here is the sequence that we proposed now a few years back. But now we have all the pieces in place to substantiate this sequence. And I'm going to show you those pieces finally. So this sort of is really a capstone lecture. And to be honest, it's the first time I'm presenting it publicly like this, because we just presented a lot of this really big data at DDW. So food poisoning starts the process. I was fine until I had food poisoning, which is this acute gastroenteritis. So the bugs that do that are E. coli, Campylobacter, Shigella, Salmonella, those typical organisms after eating tainted food. And then this toxin is common to these organisms, and it leads to autoimmunity to a protein called vinculin, which is a protein in you. And then you get a reduction in special nerve cells, which are ICCs, which are important for the migrating motor complex, which is the cleaning wave of the small intestine. And when your small bowel doesn't clean, you get bacterial overgrowth. And I'm going to show you the proof by all these different methodologies. And then, of course, we know rifaximin has been effective in irritable bowel syndrome, but let's go beyond that now as we start to understand what's going on exactly. So what I'm going to talk about first is, what is the proof that food poisoning causes IBS? And I'm going to show you the best data on this. But the best clinical study is from the Mayo Clinic. This is from 2017 in the journal Gastroenterology, which is our top GI journal. And what you can see is that food poisoning causes IBS, full stop. So these were studies where they looked at, let's say there was an outbreak of Salmonella from, for example, in Spain. There was an outbreak of Salmonella on a particular religious holiday when they were eating these cream cakes. And then they followed them over time and found that they developed IBS. One example. All of these, there's more than 20 examples. And then they pooled them together and said, well, if you get food poisoning and you've never had IBS your whole life, you now have a 1 in 9 chance or 11% chance of developing IBS. And for many of the people who transition from food poisoning to IBS, they have IBS indefinitely. And so that's the starting point of this whole story, is this food poisoning leading to IBS. This is a very complicated study that we published because We don't know. So what people are saying, well, okay, food poisoning causes IBS. But if you have 1,000 IBS patients in your clinic, how many of them had food poisoning? They don't remember. It's 10 years of IBS. They don't remember the first 2 days of diarrhea from eating bad sushi. So what we have to do is a mathematical model. So we did this. We took the data from the Centers for Disease Control on the rates, or what we call the incidence, of food poisoning in the United States. So we said this. We said, let's pretend nobody in the U.S., 300 million people, nobody has IBS today. And then overlaid that, the incidence of food poisoning in the U.S., because food poisoning is a reportable illness, the CDC has accurate data on food poisoning. And then we know that 11% develop IBS, but some of them get better, and not everybody has IBS indefinitely. And then creating this math model and then modeling it over a period of time, we reach what's called a steady state at about 10 years. And the steady state is 9% of the entire 300 million population of the U.S., using all the available data at the time, could have IBS from food poisoning. So that's 2/3 of all the IBS we know in the U.S., hence the 60-70% we think that food poisoning and SIBO and all of the things I'm going to show you are likely related to food poisoning in the development of IBS. So this is an important study. There's a lot of assumptions when you do mathematical models, because it's very difficult to do a 10-year entire U.S. population study. It would cost a tremendous amount of money and be impractical. So what proof do we have that food poisoning causes bacterial overgrowth, causes IBS? So there's a lot of data here, so I'll take you through that. The first is that we actually, this is now back in 2008, so this has been in the works for a long time in our lab. We said, well, food poisoning, the most common cause of food poisoning in the United States is Campylobacter. Hard to work with. The lab had to have certain certifications because it's considered a significant pathogen or bacteria that can cause illness. And so we have to learn how to handle it so we don't get sick. And then the animals are, you know, in their cages, and you got to handle the cage material in a particular way. So it's a very complicated process to handle this organism in an animal. But we infected animals on the right, not infected. So this is the placebo group on the left. And then we waited 3 months. So the food poisoning had to be gone. So the Campylobacter in the stool had to be gone, meaning they had the food poisoning, they recovered from the food poisoning. Now we wait 3 months, just like is typical for IBS. About 3 months after the food poisoning is gone, the IBS creeps in. And what we did was we looked at the stool of these animals, and then we looked to see if they had SIBO. And 27% of the rats who had food poisoning had SIBO. Now, what we saw in the humans was 11%, not 27%. But we gave a large quantity of Campylobacter. So this would not be the kind of food poisoning you get. This is a much more dramatic amount of food poisoning, so we're increasing the gain on this. But 27% of the rats developed SIBO. But more importantly, the C plus means they got Campylobacter. The SIBO plus means now they have SIBO. And then we went back to what their stools were, and their stools, 85% of these animals who have exposed to Campylobacter and now have SIBO have sort of a diarrhea alternating pattern. So not only did the rats, you know, get SIBO, that the food poisoning helped them develop IBS, which is this altered stool form. The only point to make down here is the only thing found in humans with post-infectious IBS is increased of these special white cells in the rectum of humans. And so we checked that in animals too, and lo and behold, we got the same thing. So this 2008 paper was the starting point of trying to understand irritable bowel syndrome and SIBO relationship, because once you have an animal model that mimics exactly what humans get, we can use that to study drugs, we can use that to study all the facets of how this happens, and that's what we've done since. So fast forward to 2022. I'm not skipping steps, but I'm going to show you this. This is a study that we published in collaboration with Will Takakura, who's now at Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Mark Riddle, who's a world expert in food poisoning. And what this is called the Bradford Hill Criteria. What the Bradford Hill Criteria is meant to do is to study cause and effect. So to meet the Bradford Hill Criteria means cause and effect is essentially proven. So you have to look at all these criteria on the left, consistency, temporality, biological gradient, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not going to go through all the details, but the evidence in 2022 is absolutely Campylobacter specifically causes irritable bowel syndrome. And many of the studies that prove this are ours, plus others from around the world who have done some good research showing that this is a true, true statement that Campylobacter causes irritable bowel syndrome. So now we talked a little bit about CDTB because that's the toxin from food poisoning, and all these organisms which are now faded can cause it. But let's talk about, so what does CDTB do? How does it manifest? So we're going to try and go through the really deep science, and I'm not going to let it get above your head, deep science that what CDTB does to your body or the rat's body, and then how it does what it does to get you to the point where you develop SIBO. So I've already mentioned this two or three times. Look at how different Shigella, Salmonella, Campylobacter, and E. coli are. Very different organisms, even just from their appearance and pictures. And yet, they all share this one toxin. And there are very few bugs that have this toxin. But this toxin obviously gives these organisms that are we call pathogens, or they cause disease, an advantage of some kind that until now we didn't quite understand, and we still have more to learn. But CDTB is part of the important toxins that these organisms use to try and do something to us to their advantage. These are a lot of sort of colorful images, but this is what's called immunofluorescence staining. We use antibodies, we put it on tissue, and then under a special microscope using fluorescence, we can see where the antibody is going. And what we found, this is back in 2015, is that when we take the antibody to CDTB and we put it on tissue, it's binding to these circles here. And you can see this is a special stain for this type of cell that we've known forever. This stain works for this cell. And this is the CDTB antibody, so an antibody to CDTB. And you can see that it turns from green, which it's binding to that cell, and then this antibody, and when you put them together, it's orange, meaning that our CDTB antibody is binding to the same cell as a stain that stains for this particular cell. And this cell is the cell called an interstitial cell of Cajal that is important for keeping your cleaning wave going. And so the antibodies to CDTB are binding to the cells that are important. These are nerve cells that keep your cleaning wave going. And it also binds to other nerve cells. These are called ganglia, and the same sort of thing is happening. So when you get exposed to this toxin, the antibodies you form against this toxin are binding to you and the nerves of your gut. But we had to figure out how this was happening, and that's on the right side. We got these special enteric neuronal stem cells, and then we broke them apart to just get their contents. And then we did what's called a Western blot, and then we put the antibodies on this Western blot. And what the antibody to CDTB bound to was something in the cells of these nerves, and that protein was vinculin. So while I always talk about vinculin, what I don't talk about is how many years it took to figure out it was vinculin. And we're talking 5 to 7 years to confirm this, because in science, one finding is not fact. You have to look at and I subscribe to this philosophy. You've got to look at it five different ways, and it has to come out the same. It's sort of like taking a picture of an elephant from five different angles to get its three-dimensional structure. And we have to prove it in five different angles. And we did. And I'm not going to go through more details than this because it's going to get too complicated. But we did this in so many different ways to show that the CDTB was, the antibodies to CDTB were then becoming autoimmune to the protein vinculin. And that was causing the change in the movement of the gut because of this effect on these specific nerves and nerve cells. So where,
wait a second, Dr. Pimentel, I just want to acknowledge the work, because like you're not getting like people applauding, but like I want to stand up and cheer when you're saying this, how you've connected all of this together. And I just want everyone to like take a breath and absorb this progress that you've made. I mean, it's incredible. And yeah. I know you're just working away like in the forest. So, and then you go to these conferences and people, you know, respond and stuff, but just, we want to thank you so much for all of your work and just absorb what he's saying. You guys, this is so huge. Okay. Sorry. Thank you.
And actually, I just want to say that I was following along paper after paper, painstaking so cool. One after, and then eventually the final summary paper, it was just like reading a serial novel, you know, incredible.
Yeah. It's a lot of work to put the pieces together. And resources, and NIH funds none of this. And this is remarkable because most of what I'm showing you, we applied for NIH grants and got zilch, because the NIH funds mostly inflammatory bowel disease and other conditions. Those are important too. But IBS is the biggest, most expensive condition that affects people of all ages. And doesn't get the respect, but now it's getting respect. And I think this story is part of the respect that IBS is getting. Okay, so thank you for your little break. So now let's talk about that vinculin protein. This is the vinculin gene. Where is that particular? What I didn't say is that vinculin comes in many forms in different cells. But only the 117 means the size of vinculin, that particular type of vinculin is the one that the antibody binds to. And they are present. See, vinculin of a different type is in the heart and other smooth muscles. But the vinculin we're talking about is in the small intestine and colon and in the skin. This is important for another thing we're working on, which is beyond the scope of this lecture, but it's important for the nerves of the gut. Okay, so this is a cartoon. This is from this paper here. And now this is a little complicated, but this is, if you look here, this is this yellow sort of fadedness is your cell membrane. So you're inside the cell here, you're outside the cell here. And what's happening is that vinculin is this green thing that is sort of like a motor at the end of these chains. So think of this like a rope. These are the ropes that keep your cell in its shape. And vinculin is at the end, facilitating those ropes stretching out to grab on to the next cell. So let me show you what that looks like in our lab. So these are cells, you can see they're reaching out, trying to grab onto each other and attach. The red is vinculin, the green are those ropes that are called actin. So what I tell my patients is think of it like this, the wiring in your house. If the wire is there, but it can't reach the switch for the lights to turn on, there's no electricity. You can be this far, it won't turn on, this far, it won't turn on, this far, it won't turn on, this far, it won't turn on. They have to be touching. So vinculin helps the wires stretch and grab on to the next cell. And this is very important for nerves to grab on to each other so that the circuit is complete. And that's what goes wrong. So now let's talk about those cells, those little round cells that I told you earlier. Look what happens. I'm going to show you the top diagram here. You can see the arrows are pointing to the cells. This is normal. Cell, 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 cell. And what you can't see is the little string, like the wire connecting all these cells. Cell, 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 cell. That's normal. If you got Campylobacter, the cells are further apart and a little bit more goofy looking. And this is what happens if you had Campylobacter and you have SIBO. There's one cell here poorly stained and then nothing. Maybe one here and then nothing. So you can see these cells were counted blindly and that the lowest number of cells was always in the Campylobacter and the SIBO positive animals. So these cells are decreased in number, and I'll show you what the implications for that are. And that will be in this section here. So now we know what the CDTB does, how it creates antivinculin, and that it's reducing these important cells that are important for the migrating motor complex. So how does this lead to SIBO? So this is a study way back in 2002. This is our paper where we showed for the first time healthy people and IBS patients with SIBO, the number of migrating motor complexes. And you can see it's dramatic. Look at that p-value. It's dramatically decreased in patients with IBS who have SIBO. And then also the migrating motor complex, which is this contraction to clean your gut, is also abbreviated. So it's not only that it doesn't occur, but that even the ones that do occur are kind of incomplete, if you want to put it that way. But what I'll tell you is that half of the patients in this group never had any that we could see. So that's what this says. 50% of IBS subjects with SIBO had no MMC during the recording period. So MMCs are the consequence of all of this phenomenon. I show this paper because I want to give credit to Van Trappen, who actually didn't discover the cleaning waves. That was Dr. Krzyzewski from the Mayo Clinic. But what Dr. Van Trappen said is these waves lead to overgrowth if you don't have them. And so this was a seminal paper from 1977. And so all these pieces start to come together as to some of these historical works that didn't quite know the consequences of all of this or how this all fit together, but certainly deserve credit for their discoveries before where we are. So now let's take it in a different way. So now we know CDTB and antivinculin form, but how does that link to SIBO and or treatment? So we said, well, if CDTB is the ultimate cause of IBS, then why do we need to give Campylobacter? Let's just give CDTB. So we did this study where we gave CDTB as a vaccine to animals, and the vaccine was given a second time 3 weeks later, just like your COVID. You get the first shot, then 3 weeks later, you get the second shot, and then you see what happens. And that's what we did here. So all these animals saw was CDTB, but the remarkable thing is the CDTB went into their muscle, in the arm or the leg, not in their gut. But what happens in the gut is amazing. So what we saw was they got anti-CDTB antibodies. So they didn't have any before because they never seen this toxin. Now all of a sudden, of course, they have the toxin, but then they also had an elevation in vinculin antibodies. So by just giving CDTB, we made them have autoimmunity to vinculin. And that is a pretty incredible finding. But more importantly, and I want you to focus on this graph on the right, the rats that got the CDTB inoculation got SIBO in their duodenum and their ileum. Or the ileum is the last part of the small intestine. The duodenum is the first part of the small intestine. Basically, the small intestine, the bacterial count went up. So we started to postulate that this is how things happen. You get CDTB exposure, you form a bunch of antibodies, you don't like CDTB at all. You don't know it, you don't like it, you don't like this part, you don't like this part, you don't like this part. So you form a lot more antibodies to CDTB after infection. But one of these antibodies looks a lot like vinculin or a section of vinculin. And now we know this sequence and we know this sequence, which you can't talk about yet. But it will be very important for future prevention, vaccination for people who travel, and other things that we're also working on, because we can prevent IBS.
Whoa, that's exciting. Hello, You can prevent IBS. Does that mean you can prevent food poisoning?
Yes, that's possible too. But even if you get food poisoning, it'd be milder, and we hope never create IBS in patients. So that is a five-year goal, but stay tuned for more of that. Okay, so now this was presented at DDW. This is going to get, again, very deep, very complicated, but this is public information. And this is some of our team members, Dr. Leite, who's one of our project scientists, really spearheaded some of the analysis here and the research with us. So this is really interesting. So we did the study with the CDTV again, but we wanted to take this to a new level with larger numbers to really figure out what exactly is going on with the microbiome now. We know they get SIBO, but what kind of SIBO? Where is it? How is it? How is it factoring? And again, same as the previous experiment, this is the control group. This is the injected group with CDTB. Of course, their antibodies go way up. Their stool wet weight goes up. Now, if you think between going from about 61 to 63 is not a large jump, it's huge for humans too. 2% more water in your gut. Remember, 8 liters of water a day, 2% of 8 liters is a lot of water. So this is an incredible jump in water weight. And the amount of CDTB antibody was proportional to the amount of increase in water weight. So the rats were getting, the more they reacted to CDTB, the more wet their stool was. Now, I'm showing like a complicated cytokine panel. These are inflammation that's happening in the body of the animal. This cytokine was changed, this one. You don't need to know the cytokines. Here's what we did next. We said, let's pretend we put blinders on. We had no idea we gave them the toxin. We have no idea. Let's just take these cytokines and say, if this happened in a normal person or an animal, what would the, and there's a software where you just put the cytokines in and it tells you what would have been guessed to have happened to that animal in order to get these cytokines the way they are. So it's called a predictive pathway. And I know it's complicated. Forget about what's in the middle. I'm going to point to what's important. And let me just, so the upstream, what they're saying is, the thing that could cause these cytokines to be the way they are is lipopolysaccharide, which is a protein in the bacteria that are typical of SIBO. Secondly, what these cytokines would have predicted is autoimmunity, which we already know is happening. And what these cytokines would have predicted is diarrhea, which we already showed. So even not measuring diarrhea, not measuring the vinculin antibodies, not measuring the SIBO, just that change in your inflammation predicts exactly IBS and SIBO. And so it's just internal validation of all of these factors. We then sequenced the animals in the duodenum, the ileum, the cecum, and the stool. Cecum is the first part of the colon as the small bowel enters. And all the remarkable things happen in the small bowel. You can see the control, big change. Control, big change. Small changes here. So not happening in the colon. This is not happening in the colon. This is happening in the small intestine. So we wanted to know what the big changes are. So we know SIBO. I showed you this two different ways, two different studies. But what is the SIBO? And so the animals that got this toxin, they went in three different directions after the toxin. So orange is where the bacteria, the sort of a summary of their microbiome. The normal are orange. So look at the orange cluster here. So a group of rats who got CDTB stayed in the orange area. That's the green. But then the rest of the rats went in two different directions. One direction was a lot more E. coli. Another direction was a lot of this organism, desulfovibrio. Desulfovibrio produces hydrogen sulfide. E. coli produces hydrogen. This is going to become very important when we get the breath testing. And I know you know about hydrogen, methane, hydrogen sulfide, But look what we're finding in the rats, exactly the same thing, that the rats on the diarrhea side are going in two bad microbiome directions, the E. coli or the desulfovibrio direction. And that's really important because that's what's happening in IBS. The IBS-D patient is two different IBS-Ds. One is a hydrogen type of IBS-D, and another is a hydrogen sulfide IBS-D, as I'll show you later. But we're seeing the same thing in the animal model, which is very reassuring that we're on the right track. Okay, so what about measuring these toxins and these antibodies in humans, and how does that help us? Well, this is the second generation test, and you got to use the second generation test because it's been improved so much from previous versions that it really is the gold standard for this testing now. And this is the IBS Smart Test because it accurately, the problem with these proteins is they're unstable, and we figured out how to stabilize where the antibody combined, and this is really, really important to get these numbers. But here it is. If you measure anti-CDTB in IBS, you can discriminate from Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, and other IBD. Same thing with anti-vinculin. You can even more clearly discriminate and be able to say a person has irritable bowel syndrome, and this was why it happened, because of food poisoning. So now we're confident in that. And look what happens if you have both antibodies positive, even if it's just one. The post-test probability of IBS is up to 98%. So people are going to say, well, 98%, 89%. Medical certainty is 80%. So anything over 80% is considered medical certainty. So we're in medical certainty if either of these tests or markers are positive or both are positive. And the positive predictive value is over 95%, so that's really important. People focus on sensitivity, so sensitivity is low on this test. It's not low. Remember, I'm testing in this study, it's not 100 patients, but just to give you an example, 100 people, if they did the test, if you combine the two, it'd be about 56%, but 43% would be positive for CDTB, 52% would be positive for vinculin, some would have both, but it shouldn't be higher than 56, 60% because only 56 to 60% of IBS is due to food poisoning. So it's right in the right spot. So don't focus here because this is actually correct. If I knew who had food poisoning, this could be 100%. I don't know. So focus on the specificity and the medical certainty that you get with this test. All right, so we published this year, which really kind of shows you the story in cartoons of what I've been telling you this whole time. You've got beautiful organisms here. Look at all the different colors, different shapes, different sizes. That's all normal. That's all okay. These are these special round circle cells I told you before. This is the ganglia that I showed you before, and then the muscle layers of the gut. And then you get Campylobacter, this green character that's now taken over here. You get the CDTB toxin entering your body. You then first form anti-CDTB antibodies. So here they are trying to get rid of the toxin. So there are patients who have IBS who only have CDTB antibodies, but they may eventually develop antivinculin or not, because if they tend to have autoimmune disease, they're more likely to develop it. But the antivinculin doesn't happen till much later, 3 months after the food poisoning. So you can be positive for one or the other or both, and it's still post-infectious IBS. So that's the explanation there. And when the antivinculin rises, as time goes on, you can see the characters here. These are now E. coli and Klebsiella, which I'll talk about. Now, let's go to the meat, which is breath testing, culture. How do I apply this? How do I treat this? And so I'm going to now go through the meat of what you need, what you can do today and what's coming. So this is a meta-analysis of breath testing. So breath testing should not be controversial because this study from Shaw, which is a study from Australia, looked at all the breath testing studies and absolutely without a shadow of a doubt, breath testing is more likely to be abnormal in IBS to suggest SIBO than in healthy controls. And that's a full stop now. And now we think lactulose is about 49% of IBS test positive on lactulose. Now it varies from center to center, so it's a little bit of a scatter plot because some centers, they don't think of IBS as a microbiological condition, so they get referred in a different pattern. And so it just depends on what center. But on average, you're talking about half the patients should be positive. So we now understand that there are three gases, not just hydrogen and methane. There's hydrogen producers, then there's hydrogen sulfide producers, which eat up the hydrogen to make hydrogen sulfide. So your flatline breath tests aren't normal. They're hydrogen sulfide likely, and that needs to be checked. And then there are methane producers that eat four hydrogens to make one methane, and that's associated with constipation. The hydrogen sulfide is associated with diarrhea. And so you have to measure all three gases. Now, what we thought of until this year is that E. coli and Klebsiella were the hydrogen producers of SIBO, and they are, but they're not the ones that are helping methane. So the story has changed this fall, the few weeks ago when we presented at DDW, and I'll take you through that. Small bowel culture shows the same thing. More SIBO in IBS versus healthy controls. And this is the case from a study all the way back in 2007, culturing the small intestine. We were part of this study with a group in Greece, and this is our 60% number. So this is a really important study because this for once and for all gives us a sort of a seat to sit on. 60% of IBS has SIBO, DIBS, diarrhea IBS. 60% have SIBO by culture, not by breath test, but by culture. So this is the gold standard. It wasn't until 2015 that we started to understand E. coli and Klebsiella are the two bad characters. So E. coli is here, Klebsiella is here, and you say, well, that's not a big rise, but each number here is 10 times more. So it's a log 10 scale. So there's 10 times more E. coli and Klebsiella in IBSD than in healthy people. So that's not good. One final study on culture just came out in 2020, again from the Shaw group in Australia. And look at functional GI disorders, which is the group that is composed mostly of IBS, but some functional dyspepsia patients. Look at that compared to controls, compared to Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. It's very clear that there's too many bacteria in the small bowel of IBS. So now I want to introduce the REIMAGINE study. The REIMAGINE study is our flagship study. We started this now 4 years ago. We have, we're trying to get now to 700 patients before the end of the year in this trial. It's the largest database of small bowel juice collected from patients who are just undergoing a scope from above. You can't be going for colonoscopy because colonoscopy washes things out. We don't want a washed out small bowel. We want to see what your small bowel looks like in its native state. And we're studying all these diseases, but we're going to talk mostly about SIBO. The REIMAGINE study gave us the first beautiful look at SIBO in its detail. And it's similar to what I said, E. coli, Klebsiella, and I'll show you that. But this is a sunburst diagram that in the middle is bacteria, and then you break it down to the categories until you get to the genus and the species. And essentially what you can see here is this is Klebsiella and this is E. coli in the SIBO. Look at the healthy people with no SIBO. Klebsiella is this tiny little sliver here and E. coli is this tiny little square here. So imagine that nearly 40% of all the bacteria in your duodenum, in your small bowel, is just two characters taking over like weeds in the garden. And I have some slides which I removed for the sake of trying to keep things under control for time that show how these two bugs basically destroy the rest. They're squishing everybody else down. They're taking over and forcing the others out. The healthy ones, I mean. But this is an important slide, and I'm going to spend a few seconds on this because, you know, people talk glucose, 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 and it's a little frustrating for me at this point now because I've heard the glucose story over and over again, And then there was conversations at DDW saying, well, we recommend glucose. On what basis? Where are the studies? There are so many studies on lactulose. There's hardly any on glucose, but people are saying glucose. This study is from the Reimagine, patients who had lactulose breath tests, and we compared the lactulose breath test to culture, and it's good, and we compared it to sequencing, and it correlates with the E. coli and Klebsiella, which are gamma proteobacteria. But not just that, the lactulose breath test, the 20 rise at 90, which is the cutoff for a positive test, correlates with the upregulation of hydrogen enzyme pathways in the bacteria that are present in the duodenum. So the hydrogen mechanisms, the machinery to make hydrogen, is increased in the small bowel of a patient with a positive breath test on lactulose. There's nothing like this on glucose. There's no data like this on glucose. So, you know, the data for lactulose are overwhelming. I'm not saying you shouldn't do glucose. But what you have to understand is glucose is often negative, and then you do lactulose and you get a positive test. The validity of all the things I'm going to show you are based on lactulose. The other thing that critics have said is, well, you know, we used to say 10 to the fifth or greater than 100,000 bacteria in the gut is SIBO. That's not true either. And we published an initial paper reviewing healthy people. No healthy person is more than 10 to the 3, which is 1,000 bacteria. So in our sequencing analysis from the small bowel, we showed that everything looks like this up until you get to 1,000 bacteria per milliliter, up until you get that cutoff. And then all hell breaks loose. So 10 to the 3, or 1,000 bacteria per milliliter, is the tipping point for the small bowel to become SIBO. So this has been proven now. Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about intestinal methanogen overgrowth. I know that was part of the what people wanted to converse about. So you get this hydrogen production. We now know the bug, Methanobrevibacter smithii, in the colon and the small bowel, and it converts the hydrogen to methane, and that methane is proportional. So more methane, more constipation and bloating. It also lowers your heart rate, the methane. So higher methane, lower heart rate. This is a new finding we have, and there are some anti-inflammatory effects, which I'm not going to get into here, but we're understanding M. smithii, or this bug that produces methane, more clearly. New data from DDW. So remember, we changed this to, it used to be SIBO with methane, and then it became intestinal methanogen overgrowth, because methanogens don't just live in the small bowel. Well, interesting. We use the Reimagine study to look at all the methanogens that are known to colonize humans. And there's a couple of things you'll notice. Methanobrevibacter, which is the big, the one that produces methane, we believe in the EMO, intestinal methanogen overgrowth, in the small bowel, 14 out of 14 people had it. Only 5 out of 14 had it in stool. So yes, the small bowel is where it's most present, but it is also present in stool. And then there are other characters that produce methane at a lower proportion. But the point is, this organism is everywhere. Look, it's in this Methanobrevibacter is in the duodenum, in the jejunum, in the ileum, and in stool. So it is intestinal methanogen overgrowth, not SIBO. It's not just in the small intestine. So this is the first study, you're seeing this first, the first study ever to look at the entire gut and look for these methanogens and how they're distributed through the intestinal tract. You say, well, okay, great. We already knew this, but we didn't for the purpose of developing drugs. Drugs have to be delivered where the characters are. And so understanding the characters helps us develop the next level of drugs, which I told you were about a year ahead of these data. So use your imagination. We're trying to develop things based on this work. And the other gas is the hydrogen sulfide. So hydrogen produced by organisms like E. coli are used by bacteria to produce hydrogen sulfide, and hydrogen sulfide causes diarrhea, urgency, and pain, which is the IBS-D phenotype. So for the first time, we can now measure hydrogen sulfide, hydrogen, and methane on a breath test that you can do at home. But this was not easy. Again, what we said earlier, Siobhan, takes years and years to go from the idea to be able to validate something that can work effectively and correctly. And so you can't transport hydrogen sulfide easily. You have to get a bag with a large quantity of gas, because the sensors need more gas, that is rated and capable of storing all of these gases without them decomposing. Hydrogen sulfide decomposes very easily, and so it's highly reactive. And then the sensors have to be oriented in a particular fashion so all three gases can be measured from the same breath. And then we have to establish a clinical cutoff using the bag, using the kit, using the machine that was developed, and all of that. So all of that took a lot of time. But what we can see is the hydrogen is exactly like other hydrogen breath tests. The methane is exactly like other methane breath tests, although the sensors in here are more accurate to a narrower range. But here's our first results, taking patients with diarrhea, not necessarily IBS, but diarrhea patients. And so the initial cutoff looked like 5, but now that we have IBS-D, the cutoff at this moment is 3, and that may change as we continue to get more data. But without a doubt, the more hydrogen sulfide you produce, the more severe your diarrhea is. And so we know this is sort of starting to look like a cause and effect relationship. Okay, so how do we treat all of this? You probably know this study. This is from the New England Journal of Medicine, that rifaximin, this is a rifaximin study. Rifaximin made everything better, and it made it better for up to 3 months. And so on this basis, the FDA approved rifaximin, an antibiotic for the treatment of irritable bowel syndrome, because IBS is a microbiome condition. And that is an important pivot point in 2011. It took about 10 years to get to this FDA verdict. But what we then learned is that if you did a breath test before taking rifaximin, if you did nothing, no breath test, rifaximin would have an effectiveness of about 44% in if you took 100 consecutive IBS patients with diarrhea. But if you had a negative breath test to start with, 25% would be successfully treated. But if the breath test was positive, 56% higher, so that's higher. And then if the breath test became normal because the rifaximin worked, 76% met this very difficult FDA endpoint. So you can see that knowing that you have the alteration in the microbiome or SIBO really helps you with IBS. For methane, we showed in this double-blind study that neomycin by itself isn't very good. We also showed that rifaximin by itself isn't very good. But when you combine the two, they really have a better effect on making that constipation score go down in the methane patients. And if you get rid of methane, that's the patient that did the best in this trial. Finally, we are, again, a year ahead of what you are seeing here today. So we are working on hydrogen sulfide right now with the therapy and clinical trials. We are doing these things. But here's what we do now because of this study from 1998. Michael Levitt was a tremendous figure in gut microbiology, really, in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. You may know his son who wrote Freakonomics, a little tidbit. Basically, bismuth markedly decreases hydrogen sulfide. So we use this study as leverage for treating. Now, the final piece, if we have time. We have time, Siobhan? Okay. All right, so this is the study we presented at DDW. And so this is really the most important piece of data that we've had so far, because it really ties home everything that I've said, but also ties home the microbiome. We have to understand and continue to understand the details so we can improve our therapies. So we took patients who were in a double-blind study for IBS-D. So these are perfect D patients. You can't be in a clinical trial for IBS-D under FDA without being perfect. And we took another study of IBS-C, similar type of scenario, perfect IBS-C patients. Some of these, 53%, were methane positive, some were not. And then these, of course, they're very similar in their demographics. We did breath tests in all of these patients. You can see that in the IBS-C with methane, obviously they had methane, so methane was elevated. But the D patients did not have methane, and the IBS-C without methane did not have methane, of course. But this is interesting. So when you look at hydrogen, look at the threshold. Remember, 90 more than 20, 90 more than 20, it's above 20. So, and it's also statistically significant. So the IBS-D patients produce hydrogen positive breath tests. The IBS-C, because they're producing methane, they don't reach that threshold as often. So you can see they're down here. Hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is higher in IBS-D versus IBS-C. I've shown you some of that, but this is a very important study from very clearly defined humans with IBS that hydrogen sulfide is on the D side. Now let's look at the microbiome. I'm not going to go through this slide. What I'm going to go through is say that if you have methane, your microbiome is completely different than if you have IBS with diarrhea. So the IBS constipators with methane are here. The IBS with diarrhea are here. Very different in these two sort of ways of looking at the entire microbiome of these humans as a group. First off, we knew this before, but again, it's showing exactly the same thing. M. smithii, Methanobrevibacter smithii, that's the bad actor in IBS-C. Doesn't matter what time of the breath test, this bug correlated, this is positive correlations, with the breath test values and negatively correlated with hydrogen. So the higher the M. smithii, the lower the hydrogen was, because M. smithii is eating hydrogen. Now, this is going to get deeply complicated, but I'm going to make it very simple for you. Remember, when methane produces methane, it needs hydrogen, but it's not getting hydrogen from E. coli and Klebsiella, those two characters. Where it's getting hydrogen now, we know as of this DDW, is it's getting it from these two characters, Christensenalaceae and Ruminococcaceae. You do not need to remember their names, but suffice it to say that we can't treat E. coli and Klebsiella in IBS-C with methanobrevibacter or methane, because these are the guys that are helping. And so let's go in more detail here. The methane organisms correlated with methane levels. These two characters that provide the hydrogen correlated with methane levels, because they need to make the hydrogen to make the methane. And also they correlated with this higher diversity, which I showed you earlier. Okay, so IBS-D side though had more bugs, these two categories of bugs, Fusobacterium and Disulfovibrio, that produce hydrogen sulfide. So in humans with IBS-D, hydrogen sulfide was increased, and these are the bugs that did it. I'm going to skip over that, but what I'm going to say here is that E. coli and Klebsiella, which is in this category, is what's giving the hydrogen to the hydrogen sulfide producing bacteria. And there's a negative correlation with all these. So hydrogen sulfide goes up, methane goes down. Methane goes up, hydrogen sulfide goes down. This is what this is showing. This is going down, this is going up. So in the D patients, this is going up and hydrogen sulfide is going up, but these are going down. So it's a yin and yang. So you're either in the middle, which is normal, or you're pulling this way to make methane, or you're pulling this way to make hydrogen sulfide to cause diarrhea. I'm not going to get into this because it's a bit complicated, but really what to say here is we then looked at what's being produced in the gut. using the chemical analyses or the analyses of the microbiome. And in the constipated patients, the emo patients, methane is being produced, methanol, methylamine, and this factor, which is the most important factor for making methane, is elevated. On the IBSD stuff side, it's all about making hydrogen sulfide. So this is the cartoon that sort of shows things. You've got hydrogen producing overgrowth, you've got hydrogen sulfide producing overgrowth, and then you've got intestinal methanogen overgrowth with production of methane. These are the bugs that are friends and helpers of this bug to make methane. The E. coli and Klebsiella are the bugs that help make hydrogen sulfide with these bugs. We now know the whole story of how the microbiome is interacting. The whole story in 2022. Okay, so back to this. This is how it works. So you make hydrogen. You make it with E. coli and Klebsiella, but not for this. But the hydrogen is being used to make hydrogen sulfide, and that gives you diarrhea. The methane, it gives you constipation, and that's how it works. So this is the whole story of what we know for the cause of food poisoning to develop irritable bowel syndrome. I've gone through each of these steps and broken them down into you in fine detail. But how do we use these tests? And so I really think in 2022, this is what we do in all of our patients now. So it really should be sort of standard. And that is, you could just simply give rifaximin with that 44% benefit if you have sort of a chronic diarrhea, sounds like IBS. But I don't. I do the antibody, because the antibody tells me how bad that patient's going to be. It gives the patient the answer. That's what caused their IBS, food poisoning. We do the three-gas breath test now. We don't do the two-gas anymore because the two-gas breath test doesn't give us enough information. If the antibodies are positive, you know now with more than 90% certainty that food poisoning caused this for them. So you have to counsel about travel. You have to tell them these antibodies can go higher if you get food poisoning again. Be very careful, because it's going to be harder to treat your IBS if these antibodies rise. So you must know what these antibodies are. If this is negative and the breath test is negative, you better be looking for something else. And we have lots of examples now where we've done these two tests as a starting point, and they're both negative. And then we move on and we find stuff, Crohn's disease, microscopic colitis, other things. But if your three-gas breath test is positive for hydrogen, you get rifaximin. If it's positive for hydrogen sulfide, our clinic uses rifaximin bismuth. This is how I do it. We're waiting for clinical trials that are coming, as I mentioned, to guide us even better ways to treat hydrogen sulfide. And you'll see that in the coming months, maybe within the next year. Mixed patterns, I do the same thing. On the chronic constipation side, if you're just looking for methane, you could do the two-gas breath test, but I'm just doing three-gas all across the board now. So methane positive, you treat with rifaximin and neomycin. Methane negative, look for other things causing the constipation. So this is how we do it. You could substitute the neomycin for metronidazole if you don't like neomycin or you can't get neomycin. So in conclusion, this is my final slide. IBS is commonly a small bowel microbiome disease. We now know this for fact. SIBO, it's an important contributor to irritable bowel syndrome. As you see, the most important organisms for SIBO are E. coli and Klebsiella in the small bowel. Methane is associated with constipation, and we now know the bugs that are helping to feed the methane. Hydrogen sulfide is key to understanding SIBO more completely and is associated with diarrhea. So if you don't measure all three, you're missing out on some of the important pieces of what to do here. Reducing methane is important. Measuring CDTB and vinculin are important to understanding that food poisoning caused it for this patient. And because of this biomarker, number 8, you can see that IBS is really an organic disease. It is caused by these antibodies, we believe now. And so it's important to get these measurements in order to educate the patient, but also educate yourself on how to manage these patients, because they will be more difficult the higher these antibodies are. And, you know, we're developing new targets now. Now, this is as complete as we think we need to really move on treatments. You can see that if we did developed treatments 2 years ago, we may have had an incomplete understanding of what to do, but now the story is much more complete. So thank you. Sorry, I hope it wasn't too complicated, but this is amazing. Like an epic tour de force of everything.
That was incredibly comprehensive. Incredibly. Thank you so much. Before we even like lose that any thought pattern, I just want to ask you, does the microbiome reset itself after these bad players are dropped through treatment?
Yeah, I have so much data. I can't share everything on one talk. It's just too much. But we have a beautiful study that where we looked at the small bowel microbiome in a SIBO patient before and after rifaximin. And the rifaximin was effective, the patient's better. And what we see is it's sort of like, maybe this is a bad analogy, but if a gang comes into a small town and kind of takes over like the old West, yeah, then everybody either leaves or hides, right? And once you get the gang out, everybody comes back to their homes and everything goes back in order. And that's exactly what they saw. The diversity goes up, the diversity of the microbiome becomes more normal. And it's a beautiful thing to see on these sequencing studies. So it really is, you get rid of the bullies and the population returns to normal.
About how long does that usually take, doctor?
Usually it doesn't take long, weeks.
Yeah. That's awesome. Okay. And then
actually, can I just point out that is so incredibly important what you just said, because
huge.
So many people are thinking that if they take an antibiotic, in this case rifaximin, it will mess up and destroy their whole microbiome, and you know, because this does happen with other antibiotics. So important what you just said.
Yeah, I mean, we were surprised to see it as nicely as we saw it as well. There's always this concern of taking antibiotics. We've been giving rifaximin for 10 years and we haven't seen any critical problems, no resistant organisms, none of that. I think we're on safe ground with rifaximin here 10 years later.
That's huge. So we've obviously been talking about food poisoning. We have gotten a lot of questions. Especially if someone's new, just want to clarify that there are other underlying causes for SIBO and EMO.
Well, yes. So when we talk about IBS first, 60% are due to SIBO. And then on the constipation side, looks like about 50 to 60% too, if you look at that data just showed you, are EMO. So the rest of IBS is a smattering of other things. And some of those things we can figure out too. But on the SIBO side, yeah, SIBO can be caused by adhesions, could be caused by anything that causes the gut to slow down will cause SIBO. But we now have studies that have come out from other groups that show that if you made adhesions in animals, guess what goes up? E. coli and Klebsiella, same story as a regular SIBO. So we're seeing all of this sort of microbiome work pan out in other causes of SIBO as well. But remember, if there's another cause of SIBO, sometimes treating the underlying cause will be helpful. So if you have adhesions, fixing the adhesions will make you stay better. And so that's it's important to know the cause. And that's why the vinculin and CETB antibody helps you get there, because at least you know food poisoning is in part the cause.
And once you've had food poisoning, you're more susceptible to getting food poisoning.
Right. And this is a study that Mark Riddle, I mentioned his name earlier in the program. He showed that if you have IBS and you go get deployed to, you know, areas that, because he was working with the U.S. military at the time, that you're almost three times more likely to get food poisoning again. So what I think is happening is the food poisoning damages the nerves of your gut. So that if you get food poisoning again, even if you have a small amount of Campylobacter, it's enough. The cleaning waves aren't cleaning them out, and they have time to grow there and become an infection and pass on to other people. So I think the Campylobacter and these bugs are damaging you so that they can use you over and over again as a food poisoning conduit. And that's what I think, that's why they're doing this to you. But look, we're going to break that cycle. That's what we're doing. We're going to break Amen. That cycle.
But the other thing is the elemental diet. How do you see that working for the three gases? Just because, you know, we've talked a lot about the antibiotics, but we always think of the elemental diet as a difficult to do, but effective alternative. Do you still feel that way?
Well, I think the elemental diet, what it does is it starves the resources for hydrogen production. So it doesn't matter whether you have the Christensen Malassezae and Ruminococcaceae, they need food to make hydrogen, or the E. coli and Klebsiella, they need food to make hydrogen, and then the hydrogen funnels it either into the methane or the hydrogen sulfide. But the point is, you get rid of the source food, you're going to get rid of the hydrogen production, and then that will help either. But having said that, we do know that it's harder to treat methane with the elemental diet than it is the regular sort of hydrogen sulfide IBSD.
And when you, so if you're trying to reduce the hydrogen as food for methane, would taking rifaximin by itself, like if you can't get a neomycin or a flagyl script, would that help at all? Because you're reducing the hydrogen?
So we do see some reduction or some cure, quote unquote, of methanogens with just rifaximin, but it's uncommon. I would say it's less than 20% chance of getting rid of your methane with just rifaximin. But adding the two together, you get up to about 80% in getting, at least in the clinical trial, that's what we saw. So I think combining them is the way to go. Because remember, methanogens are not bacteria, they're archaea. So all of our antibiotics were designed for bacteria. It just so happens that they work a little bit in those organisms. So we don't understand what exactly we're doing that brings the methane down, whether we're killing the two hydrogen sources or whether we're actually killing the methanogen. We're still studying all of that.
And the other thing I want to just quickly ask, because it's coming in hot from all these questions, which is also for people who are new, multiple rounds of antibiotics is so unusual because we're so used to a one and done. Could you just touch on that? And then Allison, I'll let you take over with questions.
So if you look at the rifaximin target 3 trial, the people with diarrhea, it was one and done for about a third of patients who responded, which was really fantastic. But remember, there's a spectrum of IBS. I can tell you my patients with antivinculin antibody, it's usually not one and done. It's not quite that way. And the higher that antibody, the more I have patients where the antivinculin is literally at the top of the scale, and they end up in my practice being on chronic rifaximin, because the moment I stop it, that the cleaning waves are so bad that as soon as they stop the rifaximin, I don't want people to be on chronic rifaximin. That's not the goal, but I have to help patients until we can figure out a way to make this cured. So that's kind of stuff we do.
So Allison, I know I said you could have a question, but hold on, let me just finish.
Take your time.
Okay, thank you. It went out of my head. Okay, multiple rounds. And let's just get this out there about the herbs, because there are a lot of people who won't be able to get access to the scripts affordably, and then don't want to take on necessarily the elemental diet. What's been your experience with herbs? I know Dr. Seebecker loves both and has great experiences with both, but I'd just love to get your take on that.
Well, as you probably all know, there was a study by Johns Hopkins that showed that a cocktail of herbs was as good as rifaximin. So it is possible to get a combination of herbs that can be effective for this. You just have to do it under the proper supervision of somebody who knows what they're doing so that you don't have trouble. So I think there's a role for herbs in this. It's just that was a randomized control trial, remember. That wasn't like anecdote. So we have data to suggest some of these herbal preparations are effective.
Okay. I remember the other one, which was for treating the hydrogen sulfide, when you do treat with the rifaximin and that bismuth, I know a lot of people's gastroenterologists are not going to have heard of that yet, because we need to type out this transcript and have people distribute this to everybody's gastros, which I just authorized us to do a transcript so everyone can have that to share with their doctors, because I'm not sure everybody's doctor will watch a video. But for the bismuth, I know you've said that you just have people do some Pepto-Bismol. Can you just address that? Like, is it a swig? Is it the pills?
Yeah, so again, this is not a randomized controlled trial. So this is just what our experience is using Pepto-Bismol. Is we use bismuth at about 500 milligrams. You take it three times. We give it three times a day with rifaximin. It's not FDA approved for this, as you know. But similar to H. pylori, we're talking about trying to expand what rifaximin can do by adding the bismuth to it. And we see some good results with hydrogen sulfide quite commonly with that cocktail.
And then the idea about biofilms and combining it with a treatment, whatever that treatment may be. Are you guys and gals working on more discoveries about biofilms?
We have to stay tuned. We're gonna give you some more data later this year on trying to get to where E. coli and Klebsiella reside in a special way. So we hope that it would be more effective. So stay tuned.
Okay. Dr. C. Becker, handing it over to you.
Wonderful. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In that study you did with showing the two types of food poisoning, the two types of SIBO or IBS that come out of food poisoning. I just wanted to ask you a clarifying question from reading the abstract. I think you had just addressed it when you spoke, but you had three clusters and the first cluster was similar to controls in that study. But in the abstract, the language said, in fact, they had lower wet stool weight compared to controls. So that made me think, are they going towards constipation? Am I just misunderstanding that language?
Yeah, I think you're referring to the animal study. So in the animal—
Yes, the rat study.
The rat study, the animals went in three different directions. So it's sort of like if you got food poisoning, some people don't get IBS, right? And some people do. And because we're rigging the system to have more IBS with more CDTB toxin or more Campylobacter, we're going to get a higher rate than what's seen in humans. But what we're seeing is that, yeah, some of the animals who got the CDTB ended up with their microbiome looking similar to healthy animals. But, you know, maybe they had a leaning towards IBS-C. We have to dissect that further, and we haven't disclosed that information yet. But at least what they're not getting is the diarrhea side.
Okay, great. I was wondering, the organisms, the bacteria that are making the hydrogen sulfide, is it specifically Fusobacterium varium and Disulfo vibrio piger, or is it not so specific to that? Because that was in the oral presentation at DDW. Right. Just wondering, can we say that? Are you saying that? Or are you keeping it more Disulfo vibrium and Fusobacterium?
Well, so now what we're doing is we're doing what we did with methanogens. Remember, I showed you this slide with all the list of methanogens and where they are in the whole gut. We're doing that with hydrogen sulfide. So I actually don't even have that data yet because we haven't finished that analysis, because we want to figure out, because there's lots of Disulfo vibrios and lots of Fusobacteria. So we have to figure out which ones are the characters, where they are, how they're distributed through the gut and all of that. So we're working on that now, but I'll get you more details probably within the coming months.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah, but it's probably, my guess is it's not going to be just Disulfo vibrio piger or Fusobacterium varium. We just find that they're more potent to produce hydrogen sulfide. So we were able to see that signal more strongly. Just like Methanobrevibacter smithii is the most potent methanogen for producing methane, but there are some sort of weaker elements that do produce methane as well.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, and that study was also so fascinating with the methanogens characterizing them throughout the whole small, large intestine. And there was a conclusion in that was so interesting, that you said 50% of the study participants actually didn't have methanogens in their large intestine.
Yeah, so... you know, there was this back and forth argument, not just us, but in the medical community, as to, well, methanogens, Michael Levitt, just going back to Michael Levitt, who did the hydrogen sulfide, gets better with bismuth. He, during all the years he was doing work up until the 1990s, he said, methane doesn't do anything. Methane is inert. And he said, and the methanogens are only in the colon, but he didn't have access to the small bowel like we do. So now we're showing, you know, there's this push and pull. Well, are methanogens only in the colon? Are they only in the small bowel? Are they in both? And I think what we're finding is this, when it's a problem, it's in both, but More commonly, it's small bowel. So I still think we're going to leave it as emo because you can't know in any one individual whether it's both or one or the other. So I think it's wise to say that it's both, but more the small bowel, just how you stated it.
Can I chime in, Allison?
Please, yeah.
Okay. So stool testing. For a lot of people are asking, well, I have high Fusobacterium SPP and a GI map. Is it like, I don't know, that's just an example, but like, could stool testing indicate anything for emo? If like you already have the test.
Absolutely yes. Do a study. Where you show Fusobacterium at this level correlates with hydrogen sulfide at this level correlates with diarrhea at this level.
That's what
and I will be very satisfied with that. The problem is that's not being done. So you can't just say Fusobacterium is a little up and therefore it's out of whack and you got to knock it over the head because it's not that simple. And to be honest, when Fuso's up, it's not up like this. It's catastrophically up. And the same with methanogens. When they're up, they're not just up, they're up, you know. So it can't be simply like a bar thermometer of where things are. It has to be like something very significantly elevated, at least in our sample sets. That's what we're seeing. So we could actually in our data prove what the levels are that correlate, and you know, we may proceed to do that, but I think just do the research and then we'll be more believing what the stool studies are saying, but it's always more complicated.
And I just want to address the whole like audience right now about that this is tremendous. This is incredible. Obviously you guys have just been listening to it and your minds are probably blown like ours are, but it comes back to also a combination of hope and patience because it takes a long time. You've been working on it for how long now, Dr. Pimentel? Like seriously, when did you get started on all of this? You were talking about
trying to date me now. 26 years. Yes, 26 years, 27 years, something.
Right. So and there are some people on this call that weren't born yet. So I just want to really, for those of you who are frustrated and maybe sad, but then there's another group of you who are like, yeah, we're getting closer. I would invite everyone to join the group that's psyched that we're getting closer because this is hope. This is incredible. How many conditions can you think of out there that are not getting paid attention to and that we have, science hasn't been able to crack the code at all for ages. And yet thank goodness other progress is being made as well. So this is just exciting and it feels very, very slow. In some ways, Dr. Pimentel will feel the slowest, I'm sure. But for those of you who are frustrated, hang in there. This is hope. This is real. It's very exciting, actually, to be witness to all of this, Dr. Pimentel, from the lab. I mean, who else gets this kind of access? Fortunately, with the internet and good souls and all of the progress and funding, we've been able to connect and get the word out even more, which is so cool. But please don't give up hope. Listen to what he said. We're going to get the transcript out. It will take not instant because I have a real human being who does it, who's smart. So give us a week for the transcript and we will send out the replay ASAP. I would say that one can go out within 24 hours. And then that link will also take you to the transcript. But also the link that we're going to send you takes you to all of the presentations that Dr. Pimentel has done for us over time, which is years and years. So if you're really like super, wow, this is amazing. Like Dr. Seebecker was saying, like, I read this study and it's been growing and growing and growing. Watch some of those. You could even watch backwards if you wanted to, but this is the most and latest and greatest and cutting edge. So if you only have an hour or so, this is the one, but it's very exciting. So I want to give everyone a reminder of hope. Dr. Pimentel, give us some more hope, please.
No, I saw a comment come across there. Some of us are older and time is not, you know, so I know. I understand. I can only go as fast as the money comes in to be able to do this and the people and the resources and all that. It's the work that you see here is through blood, sweat, and tears, finding resources here, there, and everywhere because the NIH isn't funding this. So I wish they would. I wish we would get funding like that and we could grow our team and double our team and you know, quadruple our speed. But this is what we have. You know, we're doing our best. And the funny thing is, you know, we've got this new Rome criteria coming out. I'm not trying to bash Rome, but this new Rome criteria coming out, and there's so many people on the Rome criteria trying to redefine IBS one more time. Where's the studies on cause of IBS? Let's go. You know, let's get some other people. I mean, I'm doing it. There's a couple of others in the U.S. that are trying to find the cause, but we need 20 or 30 centers in the U.S. trying to find the cause alongside us, and they're just not there because the money's not there. So anyway, that's not a pitch. That's more of just saying, look, I'm just, I can only do what we can do as fast as we can do it with the resources we have. So I wish we could help patients faster.
I know you're not doing the pitch, so I will. How can we donate? Where do we go?
I mean, sorry, I didn't mean to set that up. You know, my Twitter account has the link to a donate page. If you can donate there if you want, but if it's something larger, then we have a system at Cedars that can allow that to happen. But okay. Let's just.
That's just me being overly enthusiastic. It makes him uncomfortable because he's a scientist, but I am a band leader. Okay, so which is fine with me. Everyone has a role to play. The other thing that I wanted to recommend to everybody is to get his book, because the book is phenomenal and very easy, quick read, but super dense and with information. And somebody was asking, how can you relay this information to your gastroenterologist or your doctor or your nurse practitioner, and do it in a way that you feel like they wouldn't be feeling disrespected or whatever. We all have our egos and stuff. So I say giving the book is a great idea, but also give them the transcripts. Any other suggestions, Dr. Seebecker, Dr. Pimentel, on that?
No, I think educating your physicians is important, and hopefully there's some physicians online as well. We do that all the time. I'm speaking at various conferences, and that helps encourage the information to be disseminated. But look, 80 to 90% of gastroenterologists in the country are doing rifaximin, which is a big change from what it was 10 years ago, where nobody understood the microbiome at all. So we've come a long way, and we're going to continue to push and continue to push and continue to push until we're at the finish line of some of these roads. So.
And just here's a shameless plug that it's like on sale right now for 15% off. Healing SIBO, my book that Dr. Seebecker wrote the foreword for and read every word of. And it is a great companion. It's also my story, but there's also recipes and stuff. So a lot of good practical information there. Dr. Pimentel, when it comes to the next sort of conference that you're doing, where you're going to release another batch of awesome information, are we looking at 6 months, a year? What are you doing at 3 o'clock on that day?
You always want to get that first cut, because this is the first cut of this data, which is fantastic. So, probably by ACG, which is in late October, we'll have a lot more information and some more studies that have come out. And we're publishing a flurry of papers. Some were not part of DDW, so you'll see the more detailed information. Probably late October, early November would be another good time.
Okay. Dr. Seebecker, did you have any other questions before I grab a couple?
Yeah, I did, because Mark, you were co-author on a study that came out that you just put out that I thought was, again, so important for patients struggling with their doctors who won't order them the breath test for SIBO when they have IBS. Can you talk about that study you just put out?
Well, I think the challenge we have is that, and it's probably more the case in areas that are not near academic medical centers, you know, that people call it rural areas, but I don't call them rural. I call them just areas of the country where it's more the country physician, not necessarily somebody at a university hospital. And they just look, if I was out there seeing 60 patients a day, I couldn't keep up with all the new things as cutting edge as what we're talking about today. I just can't, because they're studying cardiology, liver, lung, all these different things all at once, have to learn everything. So, you know, it helps to keep them up to date, and sometimes patients can help in that process. And I think you know, we're all trying to get out there and reach them in various ways, but they don't necessarily know. And there are doctors who are still stuck in the idea that antidepressants, this is 1990s stuff. Antidepressants are the first line therapy for irritable bowel syndrome. And based on evidence, randomized controlled trials, there's no randomized controlled trial of a tricyclic antidepressant using FDA endpoints. So this, it makes no sense. And hopefully patients can educate their doctors too.
Yeah, I just thought it was so important because, I mean, you've had more than one of these studies come out where, you know, the conclusion is in IBS patients, incredible evidence here to run breath tests to check for SIBO. And so, I mean, this was just a DDW abstract. I'm hoping it will come out as a full paper and then patients can take it to their doctors, you know?
Yeah. Well, somebody just mentioned from Germany, I just saw the screen thing come across. Is a complicated story about Europe and SIBO, and it has a lot to do with rifaximin not being approved for IBS. And so, doctor, it's interesting because Canada, if there's anybody from Canada, shout out because I'm Canadian. Canada, their rifaximin wasn't FDA approved or their FDA equivalent up until about a year and a half ago. All of a sudden, FDA is approved. It's approved in Canada, and all the doctors want to know about it. Well, we've known about it for 10 years. Why do you now want to know about it? Well, because they're actually seeing it and their patients are getting better. Mm-hmm. And they're now starting to say, yes, IBS is a microbiome disease. And so all of a sudden, Canada has a great interest in this. It's not approved in Europe for IBS. And mm-hmm. so the doctors find it expensive, don't give it, can't give it, can't get that experience. And then Europe is tough. Somebody just said.
Yeah. Dr. Seebecker, were you going to say something?
Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask you about addressing prokinetics. We talked a lot about like up until then. So for anybody who's new and has just started learning through this particular session, could you just educate us briefly on what a prokinetic is and why it's so important?
So I didn't get into that part of it because remember the migrating motor complex, the wires being disconnected because of the antibody, the antivinculin, which is so important. But so the way I describe this to my patients is that when you have the antivinculin antibodies and the wires are not getting to the light circuit, what I tell people is, imagine you go into your house and only half the lights, the wires reach the switch. Mm-hmm. So that's what happens with SIBO. So you turn all the lights on that can turn on and it's still dim in the house. So the only thing, you can't make the wires connect because that would be getting rid of the antivinculin antibody, which we haven't quite mastered yet. But you can turn the volume of the lights that do work up. And that's what a prokinetic does. So the lights that are on are brighter and that helps make up for the lights that are off. And that's what the prokinetic does. So it helps keep you from needing the antibiotic again for a more longer period of time. And we've shown that in trials, and I didn't have time to show you that data, but that's published by us and others as well. And so, that prokinetics do work. And prucalopride is the one we tend to use, although I know some people who use low-dose naltrexone. We've also used low-dose erythromycin. That's something we do often as well. But after treatment, we use that after treatment.
And how long can someone stay on that in case their, you know, antibodies are still ruling the roost?
Yeah, well, the goal is to make you as normal as possible. So we use that, and then we will, let's say for example, if the antivinculin is very high, we might use the prucalopride at bedtime, and then over 3 or 6 months, we might decide to wean a patient off of it if they're doing terrific. And if that's the case, then we can get them off of it. But if as soon as we start weaning, symptoms start to relapse, then we put it back up again. So it just depends on what the patient's telling us and how they're feeling.
Okay. I just wanted to address that because a lot of people are afraid of doing multiple rounds of antibiotics, for example. So thank you for addressing that. And the same thing with the prokinetic. And have you found ginger at all to be helpful?
Well, ginger is a great anti-nauseant. It's not, in my view, a great antibiotic or anti, I mean, it's not a good prokinetic that I'm aware of, and I've never studied it in migrating motor complexes, so I don't know if it does anything there. So it has benefits, doesn't hurt for sure.
Okay. So we have someone from Poland. I'm so excited. My book just got published in Polish. So go find that. Hello, Poland. And then fiber. There's a lot of, you know, questions about fiber. I know when I first went to the gastro, the infamous doctor run 3 miles, he told me to run 3 miles, and that was a great laxative. I was like, I can barely move here, buddy. But anyway, he also said, here's some Metamucil. Like, and that was very upsetting and disastrous for my feelings of my intestines. To help us understand the role that fiber could or couldn't, should or shouldn't play in a SIBO, EMO patient.
Yeah, so fiber is a fuel for making hydrogen. So more fiber means more hydrogen, means more methane or hydrogen sulfide as the downstream consequence. So not good. So anything that's not absorbed but is a carbohydrate base is a problem. Like sucralose is the worst. Literally, I just talked to a patient this morning who didn't know that the gummies he was taking as a vitamin had sucralose in it, and he was complaining his SIBO might be back, this and that, and it was the gummies that had sucralose that were giving him so much problems. So we have a lot of sucralose and these non-absorbed carbohydrates. Fiber has been put in Cheerios, fiber has been put in everything, and it's causing a lot of bloating.
Okay. And so that's just, these are the most common questions that come up over and over and over again. And the other thing is, you know, Dr. Seebecker, just on a side note, has created the SIBO Pro course. So tell your practitioners about it. If they're really like interested in helping you and learning about Dr. Pimentel's research and protocols that have worked for her, the SIBO Pro course is a great idea. And then for patients, we have the SIBO recovery roadmap that goes through everything that Dr. Pimentel has been talking about for protocols that Dr. Seebecker has also used. And what about pelvic floor therapy, pelvic floor issues? Have you seen that play into this, into SIBO and EMO particularly?
Pelvic floor issues are relatively common and can factor into, so let's say you had EMO, because pelvic floor issues, well, pelvic floor issues factor into diarrhea, IBS. For example, if the pelvic floor is too relaxed, then when you're having your diarrhea, IBS, you could have incontinence, you can have other problems, which, you know, can create a lot of issues, and certainly it's very difficult to have incontinence. That's a tragedy. On the constipation side, there are pelvic floors that are too tight, so to speak, or too don't relax enough. And often the EMO is negative. So if you have a negative test for breath test for EMO, look for pelvic floor dysfunction. That's the first thing. And Dr. Rao will tell you that on his conversations with you, that pelvic floor dysfunction is critical to look for, especially if after the breath test is no methane. But even in the methane patients, if they get marginally better or they get better and the methane's gone and they still have some residual problems, you got to check for these things. Because our goal, you know, it's sort of like I say this analogy. If you have IBS with diarrhea, you know what would make you better? Morphine. Because morphine makes the pain go away. Yeah. Morphine makes the diarrhea stop because it's constipating, and you won't remember the bloating. But no, you can't give morphine. But the point is, covering up symptoms is not a treatment for the disease. Finding out what the cause of the disease and treating that makes the patient normal. I want to make my patients as normal as possible so they can go out with their friends, go to a movie, get on an airplane, not have to worry about diarrhea. That's the goal. So I'm just saying, you can always cover up symptoms with drugs, but it doesn't mean you're making the patient better. You're just giving side effects.
Absorb that beauty, that chunk of gold, as we like to say, that's gold. The other question that I had was, announcement is, you know, Dr. Seebecker and I are constantly doing free webinars, Q&As, that kind of thing. So be sure to be reading your emails with those invitations. Join that Facebook group that we have over 24,000 people in talking about these topics exactly. It's SIBO SOS Community. I know there are a lot of you watching this right now streaming there. So thank you. let's start throwing some love into the chat for Dr. Pimentel. Thank you so much, sir, for being here and for sharing your wisdom with us and giving us the scoop. You know, we love that.
Thank you so much. It was so good to talk to you both today and to everybody online. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing and keep updating you as much as possible. And I'm sorry that if I can't help everybody, but I certainly will do our best and continue to progress this.
Oh, we really appreciate it. We really appreciate
it. I mean, we are so fortunate to be living in a time when this research is occurring. You know, when, I mean, I couldn't even believe it when I first found you were doing this work. And I thought, well, thank God somebody's doing something to figure it out, because we can't figure out how to treat it, cure it, make it go away unless we know what it is.
Good point.
So that's what Dr. Pimentel's been doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care, Dr. Pimentel.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. If everyone else wants to just stay on for a minute, we will we'll let you know that. Thank you, Dr. Seebecker, as always. Dr. Seebecker and I do these a lot of free webinars throughout the year. We do have those courses if you're intrigued and interested, and they are aligned with everything Dr. Pimentel is doing. So that's super, super important that you realize there is support for you.
Particularly treatment information. I saw so many questions coming in on treatment that we discuss over and over again in free webinars that we give. So if you have not come to attend some of those, please do that. We can answer your questions.
Because that is our mission, is to help you get educated so that you can be well. Because Dr. Seebecker is a SIBO patient. She and I both had, we didn't know each other when we were five, but we both got our SIBO when we were five. And so I'm so glad that she and I are friends and colleagues. And please do go to our YouTube channel as well, or the SIBO SOS YouTube channel. Dr. Seebecker is there. Her website is SIBOinfo.com.
Tons of information for your questions, folks, on these on these resources, SIBO Info, SIBO SOS.
Those are two fabulous resources for you. And we love you. We appreciate you. We're thinking of you pretty much 24/7. And we will be sending out the recording ASAP. So give us, 24 hours. I plan on doing it much sooner than that. But the transcript will give us a week. And remember, when you get these links, and even I think when you registered for this through Zoom, the registration page had all of Dr. Pimentel's other talks that he's done for us. So I know you had plenty to watch between the time you registered and today, but that page is a rich, rich resource, and we'll include it with the recording that we send out today. Anything else, Dr. Seebecker?
No, I think what he has put out in this recent series in DDW is just incredible. There were other studies we didn't get to talk about that are actually really phenomenal. You can look at, for those of you who get my newsletter, my quarterly newsletter, you can sign up at SIBO Info to get that. I went over all those studies. I put them all in there. There's some really amazing things that I just wish we had even more time with him to discuss. He's just really put out so much information in this last batch. We're really getting the full picture coming together.
Yeah, it's exciting. And the fact, you guys, he just gave us an hour and 50 minutes. We got on, the three of us got on at 9 Pacific, 12 whatever, Eastern. So, I mean, that is so, so generous of him. And I know he's not here listening right now, but I'm just putting it out into the ether. Thank you. Thank you. And gratitude to all of you, and kudos to all of you for taking the time to show up or watch the replay. I know you have a lot of other things to do, but I also know that you are honoring yourself and acknowledging that you deserve to be well by taking these right steps and action and educating yourself. And please spread the word. What you learned today, please teach other people, because that is how this is going to change. And definitely talk to your health providers about all this information. Share the link when you get it, et cetera, so that go to the YouTube channel. We have over 20,000 hours, Dr. Seebecker, now of hours watched on our YouTube channel, SIBO SOS. Which, like, I'm not even paying attention to. I hate to say it. We do something, we put it on there. So I'm so pleased, but it also shows the need. So please do. Thank you very much. I recognize so many of your names from coming so many times. And if you signed up for this through the Zoom link, then we have your email address. So you'll automatically, Not a, yeah, I think that that will mean that you'll get at least the recording, but you can also reply and say, hey, make sure I'm on the email list.
And okay. People were just asking, how do they sign up for my newsletter? That is my free educational website is SIBO Info. That is where you sign up for my newsletter, where I always give quarterly of all the studies that have come out.
That's such a cool site. And then SIBOinfo.com and then SIBOSOS.com. And that's a great place to get we have a testing ebook and is my IBS SIBO ebook, but we also have the schedule of the events that we're up to. So the main thing is open your emails from us because that's where the goodies are. Also 15% off at FullScript, which is a huge dispensary for professional grade supplements that Dr. C. Becker has allowed us to have access to. So thanks, Clarissa, for putting it in there. That's a really, really big deal. And I know a lot of you take advantage of it. Normally, FullScript, you know, you got to go to the doctor's office. So we really appreciate that. We also have a new friend in Rupa Health, where they are giving us the ability to share with you functional stool tests and a few other really cool tests that I hope Clarissa will put in the chat. That's going to be, I know, a tool for a lot of you. Allison, do you want to just, it's a clearinghouse for tests, and Allison picked some that she really likes. So did you want to just talk about that for a second?
We'll be adding more on there. It's just where you can get, it allows you to get functional stool testing and some other tests directly. You can order them directly. They have a staff physician that will give you a complimentary order or prescription through that dispensary. And we'll be adding more tests there. And Siobhan, I do have to go. Thank you Goodbye. To everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. We do email a fair amount. So just pick and choose what you want. And also there is a 7% fee to Rupa for those functional tests. And, you know, Dr. C. Becker and I really considered it was an easy yes for us. Here's why. And do share the information that you receive with your practitioners. But a lot of people have to go to a practitioner before they could even have access to some of those tests. Some of you are very savvy patients and really want to compare your last stool test with a newer one and don't want to pay for a doctor's visit necessarily. I'm not telling you not to go to the doctor. I'm saying do. However, sometimes getting one of those tests in between visits or whatever can be really handy. So Rupa does charge a 7%, you know, service fee. I think that's maybe an $18 charge to get with the doctor to sign the thing, but look, go to Rupa Health and, it's right there and, you know, check it out. If it's a fit, great. If it's not, that's fine. But we wanted to share that with you. We're really, really glad that, that service exists. It's also cool is you can keep all of your functional tests like in this one portal. If you're like me, I can't find like tests from 5 years ago and stuff. I would love to have I know I saved it on my hard drive. I know. But it's very cool to have them all in one place. Okay. Rupa Health is amazing. I know a lot of practitioners use them and they reached out to us. They were like, hey, we need to get the word out. And I was like, hey, and they have access to thousands of tests, but Dr. C. Becker cherry picked some. Okay. We will add the good links to the replay area. You don't need, if you use our links, you do not need the Rupa, like you don't need a code for Rupa or FullScript. You just have to use the links we've been providing and that we will put in the, you know, replay. Okay, you know, don't worry about copying the links. Click the email that then takes you to the replay for Dr. Pimentel and you can find them there. And you'll also see all of his other talks. And don't worry about it if the tech worked for most everyone. There were two people that did not have good tech. Don't worry. I'm sure the replay is going to be amazing. So Siobhan Sarna here saying thank you so much for being with us. Please do join the Facebook group, SIBO SOS community, so we can stay in touch. Join us for the free webinars we're going to be talking about in the emails. We could do great master classes all the time too. We just finished one on, constipation and stool testing and GERD. With Dr. Steven Sandberg Lewis, Alana Gervich, and Stephanie Kimball. That was an amazing one. There's just some really fun stuff that we're up to these days. Anyway, with that, I'm going to stop the recording. Thanks for being here.